This is VOA News. I'm Gene Randall. Iran's sudden decision to raise gasoline prices and begin rationing has prompted public protests and domestic online complaints. AP correspondent Sarah Bassett reports the anger is on full display.
Peaceful protesters chanted, "Police, support us," in major cities in Iran. A large group blocked traffic on a major highway in Tehran on Saturday, the first day of Iran's working week, calling for police to join them as the season's first snow fell. A large crowd in the city of Kermanshah also demonstrated and later drew tear gas fire from police. Iran announced the cuts to gasoline subsidies on Friday without any prior warning. The demonstrations put new pressure on the government of Iran's relatively moderate President Hassan Rouhani. As parliamentary elections loom, Rouhani has been trying to pitch Iran on the idea of staying in his landmark 2015 nuclear deal with world powers. The accord is unraveling after President Donald Trump withdrew the US from it over a year ago, raising tensions across the wider Mideast. I'm Sarah Bassett.
A car bomb exploded today in a northern Syrian town held by Turkish-backed fighters. First reports said at least 12 people were killed and several others were wounded. The area has been plagued by a number of blasts over the past month after Turkey began a military operation against Kurdish fighters it considers terrorists, who charge they have been abandoned by the United States. Voters in Sri Lanka are going to the polls today to elect a new president. The top contenders are former Defense Secretary Gotabaya Rajapaksa, the brother of a former president, and Sajith Premadasa from the governing Liberal United National Party. Muslim voters traveling by bus to polling stations in northern Sri Lanka were attacked by gunfire and stones and blocked by burning tires before the polls opened. There were no reported injuries, and police are said to be investigating. From Washington, this is VOA News. Israel says it carried out airstrikes on Hamas in Gaza today, despite Thursday's ceasefire agreement. The Israeli military said it acted after it intercepted two rockets fired from Gaza toward Israeli territory. Back in the United States, the first week of public testimony in the possible impeachment of U.S. President Donald Trump wound up with a closed House Intelligence Committee session. That's when a State Department official posted to Ukraine, quoted from a cell phone conversation he said he overheard between the president and his European Union ambassador, Gordon Sondland. David Holmes says Sondland told Mr. Trump that Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky was ready to grant his request to investigate former Vice President Joe Biden. That was just a day after Mr. Trump directly asked Zelensky to carry out an investigation. Later, Holmes said Sondland told him that a Biden probe was what he called the kind of big stuff that interested President Trump rather than helping Ukraine. Friday also provided a compelling testimony from the ousted former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch. She said her abrupt dismissal played into the hands of shady interests the world over. VOA's Catherine Gibson reports on what lies ahead in the week to come.
The first week of public impeachment inquiry hearings into President Donald Trump finished.
Do you swear or affirm that the testimony you're about to give is the truth?
Ahead, an even busier schedule of witnesses in the second week. 3 days of upcoming testimony from 8 diplomatic and national security officials who will say that U.S. foreign policy in Ukraine was subverted for the president's political interests, directed by his personal lawyer.
Rudy Giuliani has made no secret of his desire to get Ukraine to open investigations into the Bidens, as well as a conspiracy theory of Ukrainian interference in the 2016 election.
Democrats allege the president fired the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine to remove an obstacle to his plans. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Capitol Hill.
Testifying behind closed doors today is Mark Sandy, a senior official in the Office of Management and Budget. Rising floodwaters have prompted the mayor of Venice to close off some vital areas of the city. Reuters correspondent Francesca Lina reports.
The floods, known as Acqua Alta, are at the highest level in more than 50 years, threatening irreparable damage to historic treasures. The St. Mark's Byzantine Basilica was flooded for the sixth time in 1,200 years, but the fourth in the last 20. The national government allocated an initial 20 million euros to address the immediate damage on Thursday. And Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte said on Friday the government will hold a meeting on November 26th to discuss governance and the structural problems of the city.
More news at voanews.com. Gene Randall, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington, D.C.
People of South Sudan have heard enough about this problem. This time around, we need action. The government has to take actions to prove that they really have political will to implement this by releasing the rest of the amount that pledged to implement this action.
A spokesperson for the SPLM-IO is calling on the international community to pressure President Salva Kiir to help form the transitional government.
The divisional officer in Chico sent his gendarmes and police to violently dispel a meeting of the SDF potential candidates for the Chico municipal elections. I don't know how they think that people can prepare for elections without meeting and deciding strategies or even deciding who should be a candidate.
The Cameroonian main opposition party resolves to take actions to pressure the government to resolve the Anglophone crisis.
What we are saying to people is that we have to preserve peace. We don't want war. The last thing to do is to give up political solutions and go into a war. We don't want that. And there's already a lot of conflict, armed conflict in Mozambique. We're not involved in it.
And the Mozambican main opposition party, RENAMO, vows to continue to challenge the outcome of the recent general election. Those stories and more coming up. Nightline Africa. A spokesperson for the South Sudanese People's Liberation Movement in opposition, or SPLM-IO, has called on the African Union and the rest of the international community to pressure the government in Juba to guarantee the formation of a transitional government. Both Baluang says President Salva Kiir has yet to provide the much-needed funds despite promises. His remarks came after the African Union said Friday that President Kiir and his rival, former Vice President Dr. Riek Machar, has a last chance to form a government. But both Baluang says the SPLM-IO is not to blame for the delay to form the government.
The issue is not about the formation of the government, rather than it's how to bring peace to South Sudan. The agreement is very clear. It has chapters that need to be implemented in letter and spirit so that we can have a genuine peace if the agreement was implemented. It's very clear that the government in Juba is the one who's holding back the agreement and refuses to implement it in different forms. Firstly, they don't have a political will, and yet they did not release the pledge amount to implement the agreement. We think this culture of sharing blames will not help the peace process in South Sudan, rather than it might complicate it more than it is now. So we think that at the moment, the African Union should help how to implement this agreement by pressuring the party to commit to implement the agreement in letter and spirit.
Do you understand why people are expressing concern about the fact that despite the revitalized agreement signed and the pledged commitment by both sides to have this new transitional government implemented, it seemed to be dragging on for far too long, and people are still being caught in the crosshairs of the conflict? People just want South Sudanese to have peace. Do you agree to that assessment?
This assessment may not be as it is in the reality. What's happening in South Sudan is not a power struggle, so that we can think, oh, people might seem or understand that if the government was formed so that there would not be any conflict. What's happening in South Sudan, it was tragic, and a lot of lives lost in the process. Therefore, we think that the agreement itself addresses the root cause of the conflict in South Sudan. There's a need to implement that in letter and spirit, because, there's no shortcut for peace. People of South Sudan are suffering. To unveil this suffering from the children of the people of South Sudan, there's a need that the agreement itself, the provisions of the agreement, has to be implemented. Now, if we agree to form the government, in such an atmosphere now we're having in South Sudan without resolving outstanding issues. The critical outstanding issues in South Sudan is like riding and a time machine going back to 2016 to war again.
With the extension of the pre-transitional period of 100 days that was agreed in Uganda, do you think that sets the stage for a transitional unity government to be formed that will lead the country to perhaps an election?
It's all about the political will from the party. If the agreement, if the government of Sudan is really meant that they adhere to this agreement, and as the SPLM, we think that yeah, they can lead us to a transition, or they can lead us to a diplomatic and democratic process, which is the elections in South Sudan. But now all this is about the political will. Some of our partners in peace lack political will. That's why we're still talking about the extension and extension over and over again.
So now in this process, what's next? Looking at this transitional period, the president has promised he was going to provide the $1 million to ensure this transitional government is formed without delay after this 100-day period expires.
You know, people of South Sudan have heard enough about these promises. And this time around, we need action. The government has to take actions to prove that they really have political will to implement this by releasing the rest of the amount that pledged to implement this agreement and to agree with other parties so that we can resolve this issue. And we can start by that with revoking the 32 states and people going back to 10 states. This is one of the major action that should be taken by the government to show that they are really adhere to implement this agreement. As our part as an SPLM, we have done everything in our hand to show the people of South Sudan that we are for the peace in South Sudan. We have released all the political prisoners that with us. We have advocated the popular sentence that being occupied by our forces.
Both Balwang is the spokesperson for the SPLM-IO. He spoke with me from the Sudanese capital, Khartoum. The Cameroonian main opposition party, the Social Democratic Front, or SDF, has resolved not to participate in the Senate or parliamentary sessions scheduled for this month until the government resolves the ongoing conflict in the Anglophone parts of the country. The SDF says President Paul Biya's administration has so far refused to ensure proper consultations in the recently held national dialogue. The remarks came after President Biya admitted at the peace summit in France about the root causes of crisis. But Chief Paul Inji Tumasang, leader of the SDF in parliament, tells me the group's resolve will be carried out unless the president and his government expedite action to resolve the crisis.
We decided that as a result of the chaotic socio-political environment that was existing and is still existing in the country, we thought we should register our dissatisfaction as to the way the country is being run by not taking part in any elections that will be organized in this atmosphere, also with a non-consensual electoral archaic code. We did all that. We even went to the extent to say that if nothing happens, we were going to withdraw our members of parliament and senators from this session.
What was the response from the government?
Well, they organized what we consider as a non-consensual national dialogue or major national dialogue. I say non-consensual because they did it solo. We were not consulted. The commissions were unilaterally set up. The secretariat of the dialogue was done in a non-democratic manner. The topics to be discussed were not accepted by all. The chairpersons of the encounter were unilaterally selected, and there were even certain topics that were taboo. They went around saying that there should be no discussion on the form of the state, which in my view doesn't make sense, because the problems that we are facing is because the form of the state has been tampered upon severally by successive governments. So they didn't want the conference to discuss the form of the state, so which in my view is the root cause of the problem.
So now that officially President Paul Biya has acknowledged that there's a problem between the Anglophones and the Francophones based on the colonialism historical perspective, and that because we were colonized by the British, you have a way of doing things, and because the 80% of the population were colonized by the French, they have their own. So where does this leave the people of Southern Cameroon and what you are advocating for?
The next step for us is to prepare calmly for these elections, and hopefully they will go on well. Already, with such a martial environment in our part of the country, gunshots every day, dead people on the streets and the like, it will be difficult. But we are hoping that we'll do our best to turn out the population. If we turn out the population, I think we'll get a sizable percentage of the votes, and we'll move forward. We hope that the MRC syndrome will not repeat itself with what they'll call electoral hold up. But the signs are not very, very promising, because early as today, or as recently as today, the divisional officer in Tuku sent his gendarmes and police to violently dispel a meeting of the SDF potential candidates for the Tuku municipal elections. I don't know how they think that people can prepare for elections without meeting and deciding strategies, or even deciding who should be a candidate.
Chief Paul Njitu Masang is the leader of the Cameroonian main opposition SDF in parliament. He spoke with me from the capital, Yaoundé. The Mozambican main opposition party, RENAMO, is calling for calm after a constitutional court refused to cancel the outcome of the entire general election. In its ruling Friday, the constitutional court said the opposition party did not submit enough evidence to sustain its complaint. Challenging the outcome of the November 11 general election, RENAMO cited voter irregularities, rigging, and accused the ruling party FRELIMO of ballot stuffing. RENAMO's parliamentarian Jose Cruz tells me the party will keep challenging the outcome of the general election.
These are partial rejections, in fact. It's not the overall yet. The final decision will be taken next month. In the meantime, we're going to fight back. This is the last appeal court. There is no way that we can appeal later. It has to be done until the last day of the struggle. We are doing an effort to bring people in the court to understand what the problems were there on the site, on the poll. There was a lot of rigging, in fact. There was a lot of delegates from the opposition parties that were expelled from the station. This happened in thousands, in fact. Most of the observers from foreign countries and even the national observers were unable to verify all the operations.
You said you are going to fight back. How are you going to fight back? How are you going to do that?
Well, the case hasn't finished yet. The judges are still hearing and counting and evaluating the whole situation. But we have to give them the benefit of the doubt, isn't it?
But the Constitutional Court in the judgment rejected your application on the grounds that the party did not submit enough evidence to sustain your complaint. So what are you going to do differently?
In one instance, in the city of Beira, the evidence that we produced was accepted by the court as evidence that something went wrong. Their explanation is that this was not electoral crimes, like the swirling, whatever happened there, but it was due to overworked people in the whole process, and they were everybody was very tired and there was a lot of errors. So what has been rejected is the notion of crime. There was no electoral crime. There was no fraud. It was just mistakes from people who are very tired of working.
Do you think that you have a strong case that could allow the Constitutional Court to overturn the outcome of the presidential and other elections?
Well, the way we see it, the court case hasn't finished yet. Even though in partial decisions we are being defeated, but the judges may, in the end, in the overall look at the whole situation, they might change their minds, and we never know. But what we would like to do is to appeal to most people, especially parliaments, and parliament people are very keen on law preservation. And not so much governments. Understandably, governments are much more interested in their own business interests, of course. But not so parliament. Parliament, the legislature, the people who make laws, they are they're very keen on keeping the law, preserving the law. So what happened now, many governments already advancing in giving Frelimo, giving this government go ahead. Well, they already won the election, and that was very good. But that is encouraging this court. Our justice is very weak, very vulnerable. And this type of encouragement from foreign countries is not good. What we appeal to people is constraint. Do not become excited about the victors. Who won this? It's too early. Until December, sometime in the middle of December, we will have the final decision. And there's still a lot of work to be done.
What are you telling your supporters in the first hearing that this Constitutional Court has passed its ruling?
What we are saying to people is that we have to preserve peace. We don't want war. The last thing to do is to give up political solutions and go into a war. We don't want that. And there's already a lot of conflict, armed conflict in Mozambique. We're not involved in it.
Jose Cruz is a parliamentarian from the Mozambican main opposition party, RENAMO. He spoke with me from the capital, Maputo. Rwanda says it is going to confiscate vacant plots of land in the central business district in the capital, Kigali. This after saying owners have ignored warnings that they need to build there. The move has sparked controversy, with owners saying they don't have the money to develop the land. Meanwhile, lawyers are calling the confiscation unconstitutional. For viewing, Eugene Iwimana has the details from Kigali.
According to the city of Kigali, the plots to be repossessed are those that have not been developed for at least 3 years. The director of Kigali Construction and Urban Planning, Fred Muyisha, says the owners have been given formal notices as part of preparations for the Commonwealth General Assembly that Rwanda is hosting next June. He says, "We are not announcing the plan. In fact, we are implementing. People have been continuously given formal notices, and in preparing international conferences, you have to act quickly. You know, when you have a visitor home, you work hard that he finds good hygiene." The city's stance has created considerable debate. The landowners say they can't afford the buildings that are laid out in the city master plan. When you try to build the house you can't afford, authorities don't issue permits, saying that you don't comply with the master plan. They order you a type of house to build. That's why we decide to let land go undeveloped while looking for the money. For lawyers, the confiscation of undeveloped land is unconstitutional. Right to land is provided for by the Rwandan constitution. It defines clearly how to get land, and it states that this right can't be violated. In fact, the constitution says that the government is there to stop whoever tries to violate this right. Officials from 50 member countries of the Commonwealth will gather in Kigali next June for their General Assembly. In the city, it's easy to witness the heat of preparations. Roads are being retouched and new ones are being created. For President Paul Kagame, the intention is to make participants feel comfortable.
We'll be wanting to make everybody feel this is an extension of their home.
All of those preparations bear fruit. The International Congress and Convention Association has ranked Rwanda Africa's second most popular conference destination after Cape Town in South Africa. Eugene Uwimana for VOA News, Kigali, Rwanda.
The International Organization for Migration says 2019 may be the deadliest year for migrant deaths in the Americas since it began keeping records 6 years ago. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
The UN Migration Agency says fewer than 700 people have died this year while making the treacherous journey across the central Mediterranean Sea, the world's deadliest migrant corridor. It says that is one-sixth the number of deaths recorded in 2016, when fatalities reached an all-time high of nearly 4,200 on the route. IOM spokesman Joel Millman says the data show the 695 migrant fatalities reported so far this year are barely greater than the total number of 634 migrant deaths recorded in the Americas.
We've never seen anything like that before, where the principal migration routes that link Latin America to North America are now, this year, virtually as deadly as the central Mediterranean route has been for the last 6 years.
Millman attributes the surprising rise to the mass movement of refugees and migrants from Venezuela. He tells VOA more than 4 million Venezuelans have fled the country over the past 2 years. He explains such a large volume of people on the move creates conditions that will result in more fatalities.
The place we've seen it worst of all is the Caribbean, where we know of this year 157 deaths at sea. Last year at this time there were 24. So we're talking about more than six times the volume of sea deaths. And I know that the majority of those deaths in the Caribbean are Venezuelan migrants and refugees trying to get to Caribbean islands.
Millman says the nationalities of 227 people who died while heading toward the United States are unknown. He notes Latin American migrants from countries such as Honduras, Guatemala, El Salvador, and Ecuador account for the largest number of fatalities after Venezuela. Included in this year's statistics, Millman says three Cameroonians drowned off the Pacific coast of Chiapas, Mexico in the last few weeks, and one man died while in custody of U.S. Customs and Border Protection agents in California. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This weekend, put this on your to-do list. Have fun. Listen to Music Time in Africa. Hey there, I'm Heather Maxwell. Join me this Sunday for 55 minutes of the best commercial-free Pan-African music on Earth. You'll hear dancehall, jalia, new hip-co, afro beats, Sahelian live band, and more. Song of the Week features Kiz Daniel's new ode to Lagos. And Soulja Love's got a dancehall tune that's firing up the Zimbabwe Warriors for the Africa World Cup. You'll also meet reporter Samed Gaida, who brings a special deep dive report from Tamale, Ghana, about music in Dagbon.
Thank you, Hector Maxwell.
So, to do? Listen to Music Time in Africa, 1505 or 20500 Universal Time.
and you are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotin, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, Liberian President George Weah has endorsed the establishment of a war crimes court, according to some locally based international groups. The move could enable parliament to establish the court in line with international human rights standards. Many Liberians have called for a court to bring justice for atrocities committed during the West African country's civil wars. But critics say the president appears disinterested to expedite action to ensure the court is established. Jerome Verdier is a human rights lawyer who has been at the forefront of pushing for the court to be established. He joins me live in the studio here in Washington. Hello, Jerome.
Thank you.
How are you?
I'm great. Good to be here.
Good, good. So let me ask you, Jerome. How has been the fight to have this court established in Liberia?
Well, it's a fight President Weah inherited. Calls for the establishment of the court was done during the tenure of former President Sirleaf.
Right.
And because she was named in the report as one who supported the crisis, many felt that was the reason why she didn't implement the TRC recommendations. And in contrast to that, President Weah advocated the implementation of the TRC recommendation prior to becoming president.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why there's a search for implementation and disappointment that he is not making any significant move towards any implementation.
I heard sometimes you've come at the crosshairs since you kept on pushing for the court to be established. What are some of the challenges that you faced in the call for this court to be established?
Well, basically, it's the lack of political will.
Mm.
The Liberian people have understood and have called for the implementation of the TRC and establishment of the court. And a lot have been done in terms of educating people. Other issues like threats are common, it comes with the territory. So we are not bothered much by that, but there are constant threats in different ways that we are concerned with, but that has not dampened our courage and enthusiasm to ensure that there will be justice for the people in Liberia. Liberia needs justice. I don't think we're going to make any meaningful progress in that country without justice. And so there is a clarion call for that. And we are stands alone at the moment. The international community is making that call. Civil society is making that call in Liberia. Political parties are making that call. Victims are also making that call.
So why is there seemingly a lack of interest or lack of political will, as you put it, to push ahead with this? Because if everybody is calling for it, including the victims of the atrocities committed during these civil wars, the international community is backing this. Of course, you have support here in Washington as well. What is causing the delay?
Well, impunity has been a major issue in Liberia. Impunity and corruption, they are taking a form of a way of life in political and powerful cycles. And from one government to another, they will want to benefit from impunity because there's not much check and balance in government. And people are sent to power with an intention to get rich. And that is happening even today. So instituting justice would mean that holding yourself accountable, opening yourself to accountability. And unfortunately, disappointingly, this government is not prepared to hold itself accountable.
But supporters of the president, and for that matter, the government, are saying that he has endorsed the establishment of the court, which lays the groundwork for political will that he campaigned on and he has delivered. And for the establishment, well, he needs funds to do that. Liberia doesn't have money. The economy is not doing well. What's next?
Well, the president is being tricky. You know, he used to be a dribbler. And so he's playing soccer with this. He has not, in effect, called for the establishment of the court. He had written the legislature and saying that he will seek their advice. It is not the role of the legislature to advise the president. there is a presidential mandate to implement the recommendations of the TRC. That has been legally established. There's a law that says you must implement and you must report to Parliament every 3 months on your progress towards implementation. He hasn't done that, and then he writes Parliament and says, advise me. You know, so he's been a little tricky and savvy about it, but that is the wrong thing to do. If he loves Liberia, he would take it on and move for justice.
But some people are saying that in spite of the TRC's recommendations to have this court established, it will open up old wounds. People who might have been traumatized as a result of that could have flashbacks. It could cause chaos. Some people say it could even plunge Liberia into a political instability and chaos, violence perhaps. Your take?
No, that's not the case. If you have a wound, Peter, how do you cure it? You have to clean up the wound and then you begin to treat it so that it's prepared for healing. Liberia has gone through the catharsis of the conflict already. The TRC was established for 5 years. Victims are calling for justice. Everybody is calling for justice. Without justice, there wouldn't be closure, there wouldn't be reconciliation. If you see what is happening in Liberia today, corruption is very, very ripe, as it was in the last administration. And nobody is being punished. Nobody is being held accountable. And then the perpetrators are around flouting themselves in the face of victims. That is not healing.
You know, supporters of the government are saying that a lot of accusations and allegations have been made, but no single proof of evidence has been presented to say that, hey, this person stole this, embezzled this, committed financial malfeasance against what people are claiming. So where is the evidence, they say?
Where should the evidence be presented? Government has institutions that do investigation. Civil society is active. And the evidence of corruption is rife in the country. We see it. The government needs to take the will to do what needs to be done. Prior to this government, there were several audit reports that indicted people who weren't charged or tried. And the government just needs to demonstrate that it is a little bit different from previous government. The evidence abounds.
Let me ask you this question. As somebody who has been pushing for the establishment of this court, when you see some of these alleged perpetrators in the street, those who played a key role in orchestrating or carrying out these gross human rights violations during the Civil War, how do you feel and how do you react when you see them face to face?
Well, when I see them, I feel terrible that people commit war crimes. And Liberia is a free territory for them. Liberia seems to be a land of impunity because people do not have the willpower to prosecute or to institutionalize justice in a more definitive way that brings closure to the war. And it disadvantages even the victims. It victimizes them even further, that they are poor, their economy is being wrecked by these very same people. And President Weah has surrounded himself with a lot of them. So people are discouraged. Personally, I feel bad that justice has not yet been instituted in Liberia.
Well, some of them are even holding political office or have run for political office. Some political party representatives sometimes would have to go to them to seek them to endorse them to get into political office, among other issues. Do you think that has something to do with the lack of the political will to go ahead establishing the court, since perhaps they might have gone to these same people because they have influence over a section of the people they needed to vote for them in order to come to power?
Precisely, they have influence over a section of the people that they govern over. And the root cause of all of that is corruption. Corruption keeps the people poor, and it empowers those who are in authority. So they use the fruits of corruption to influence the people and manipulate their thinking. So that is why, from our point, we think that the international community needs to come in and bring more pressure to bear on the government. You know, sanctions can help. Sanctions did help in previous times to ensure that government do what they ought to do and commit to good governance. And we think that sanctions will do this time in Liberia as well to bring more pressure to bear on the administration.
Well, what about Liberians themselves? Because this is not the first time they've been calling for this court to be established. Some international organizations have been calling for it. Countries have been calling for it. Some people are even suggesting that perhaps the case should be taken to the International Criminal Court, although they might not have jurisdiction over the issue, that perhaps they could put pressure on the powers that be to ensure this happens. What is your take?
That's true. The International Court presents a different scenario, which get muddled up in legal and political matter. But what is strangely required in Liberia is the political will. Even if the ICC takes it on, we hope that the ICC can find good reasons why they should take on the case of Liberia. That would be good, but what we have now is a government that should be willing to bring justice to its own people, especially in the case of President Weah, who doesn't seem to have prior ties with warring factions and all of that. So a lot of Liberians were hoping that he, being a quote-unquote clean person, would have done the right thing. And the cries for justice are very, very loud. And if Liberia fails, then the opportunity will be very, very ripe for the ICC to intervene.
So before we go, let me ask you this question. If you have an opportunity of meeting President Weah, what would you tell him?
I'm not his advisor. I will speak
to him. No, in regards to establishing this court.
I will speak to him as an advocate and advise him to do the right thing, to seek justice for his people. That without the court, without the institutionalization of justice, Liberia is going nowhere. At the moment, the economy is in recession, and now additional banknotes are going to be printed. We are heading towards hyperinflation. There is nothing that stimulates international investment in Liberia. All looks bad. A land where there is impunity, there is no rule of law, there is no justice. It's very bad, and he's making a new record for himself. He's going to end up as one of the very bad leaders of Liberia. I think he can turn that around. It is not very late at the moment. He needs to listen to good advice and heed the cries of his own people and the international community. On this question of justice, he stands alone at the moment. It is he versus the people of Liberia versus the international community. That's not a good sign.
Jerome Verdier is a Liberian human rights lawyer. He joined us live from the VOA studios here in Washington, D.C. And right now it's time for music from our African collection. You're hearing from Willie Paul featuring Nandi with Hallelujah. Ms. V comes up next with Davi. Tubaba follows with Officially Blind. Rema with Touch My Body. And then Africando All Stars. And it all with Mandali.
Fundi mwenye slow motion, matendo yangu slow but kwenye motion. Nini fundi mwenye slow motion, matendo yangu slow but kwenye motion. Mama ni take, ni take enye ni take. Una security, baka mapepo zangu zina vaburete. Hapo juu baby vaburete, menza kuchini nifanye kama glory shake.
Ebwana mkuna jilime mkutapele. Kucheze ana nywele
Kakololo.
moja moja unapopanda kachuma mboga yani wewe
mapiga tapishana usije kuna
I'm officially blind. Maybe this is no democracy. I'm officially blind.
And that was music from the continent. We hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sale, reporter Douglas Mpuga, producer Saida Hamdoun, and our engineer for today, John Dryden, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, wood already touched by fire is not hard to set alight again. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.